Today's sutta is called the Dhammayada Sutta. The air is in the Dhamma. The reason I have chosen this sutta is because it's one of the few suttas that I think have not been done before. And I was told a while ago that it was good to do suttas we hadn't done before. So this is one of those. It's quite a monastic type of sutta. The Buddha is talking to the monks, and some of the content is sort of a little bit monastic, but it doesn't really matter because it's all basically the same, right? It's kind of maybe slightly different ends of the scale, perhaps. You're a bit further, you know, along a certain scale for monasticism, a bit different side of the scale if you're a layperson, but essentially it's all about the same kind of things anyway, so it doesn't matter that much. So this is then the Majjhima Nikaya number 3, the Dhammayada Sutta. And this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Savati, in Jeta's Grove and Atapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be heirs in the Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? If you are my heirs in material things, not my heirs in Dhamma, you will be reproached. Thus, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in material things, not as heirs in Dhamma. And I will be reproached thus. The teacher's disciples live as his heirs in material things, not as his heirs in Dhamma. So the Buddha makes here a distinction, and obviously a very important distinction, between actually realizing the teachings, practicing the teachings, and just being a beneficiary of all the material goods that come, especially here talking about bhikkhus or monastics, who become, you know, who often can be the recipients of all kind of gifts of generosity. And so obviously an important, very important thing. And it is something that you can see very much in the world today. You see how monasticism often attracts too much generosity. You see that everywhere. And of course, you can lose sight of what actually is important in these teachings. The generosity is meant as a support. They're meant to help you practice, to have enough to maintain your life, not an end in themselves, but often that's actually what happens. So, and this is a big problem and something that one always needs to look out for. And I apparently someone told me recently, Ajahn Brahm had apparently said recently, that the future danger for a monastery like Bodhinyana Monastery is not going to be lack of support, it's going to be too much support, like the future danger, right? And I think that's true. We have been raising funds for the Masara Monastery, obviously very hard work, but it is possible to have these enormous projects and actually raise enough funds for them. It means that there's a lot of generosity out there. This project, of course, is very good and very, very important, but there may come a time when it goes too far. So this is a very important thing here. And of course, if you do become an heir to material things rather than an heir to the Dhamma, then people will start to ask, why? Why is this happening? And there's two things that can be going on there. Either you're not following the teacher's instruction properly, there actually is something profound, something beautiful there to be realized, something that is really worthwhile, right? But you're taking it on board, and you're kind of going the wrong direction, and you're actually enjoying all this lesser comforts of life instead of actually going to the deep and profound and important stuff. And that is when the disciple will be blamed, because he's not actually, he or she is not actually going for the things that are really worthwhile in the Dhamma. That's when the Buddha says here, the disciples will be reproached, right? Because they're not taking aboard this beautiful teaching. On the other hand, some people will also start to wonder, well, is there anything to this Dhamma? Maybe there's nothing really much to it. If everybody is going around enjoying material things, they're talking about meditation, all this kind of stuff, but, you know, what is there to this teaching if people just go for the material things instead? And then it's almost like they're blaming the Buddha for not having you know, for not teaching a Dhamma which is profound enough, for not being there. So it always looks bad for these kind of teachings if people go for the wrong things and they become heir to the wrong things, so to speak. My Venerable Nanda here was mentioning yesterday, last night I gave a talk on secular Buddhism, he said that, well, maybe one of the reasons why many people become secular Buddhists is precisely because they see monastics are not practicing very well, right? They get turned off by monasticism, they think there's something wrong with it. And I think precisely that is the problem. This is, you know, if monastics don't live up to a standard, they don't take the lead, so to speak, in practicing properly and do kind of dodgy things, then that's exactly what happens. But the whole Dhamma gets dragged down with it. And this is kind of one of the things that the Buddha is foreseeing here, that the whole Dhamma will be dragged down because you're not living up to the responsibility of practicing these teachings. So I think it's a very important point, and the Buddha is here making this point very quite strongly here. So then you have the opposite case. If you are my heirs in Dhamma, but not my heirs in material things, you will not be reproached. But instead, it will be said, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in Dhamma, not as his heirs in material things. And I will not be reproached, as it will be said, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in Dhamma, not as his heirs in material things. Therefore, bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? Okay. So, as usual, if you want to ask questions, you're please welcome to just ask questions at any time. So don't be shy about that. We can have like a bit of a discussion if you want to. And then the Buddha goes on to give an example. It's a pretty tough example, actually, which comes up next year. How not to be an heir to material things, but an heir to the Dhamma instead. This is what the Buddha says. Now, bhikkhus, suppose that I had eaten, refused more food, had my fill, finished, had enough, had what I needed, and some alms food was left over to be thrown away. Then two bhikkhus arrived, hungry and weak, and I told them, bhikkhus, I have eaten, I have had what I needed, but there is this alms food of mine left over to be thrown away. Eat it if you like. If you do not eat it, then I shall throw it away where there is no greenery, or drop it into water where there is no life. Then one bhikkhu thought, the Blessed One has eaten, had what is needed, but there is this alms food of the Blessed One left over to be thrown away. If we do not eat it, the Blessed One will throw it away. But this has been said by the Blessed One, bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Now, this alms food is one of the material things. Suppose that instead of eating this alms food, I pass the night and day hungry and weak. And instead of eating that alms food, he passed that night and day hungry and weak. Then the second bhikkhu thought, the Blessed One has eaten, had what he has needed. But there is this alms food of the Blessed One left over to be thrown away. Suppose that I eat this alms food and pass the night and day, neither hungry nor weak. And after eating that alms food, he passed the night and day, neither hungry nor weak. Now, although that bhikkhu, by eating that alms food, passed the day, neither hungry nor weak, yet the first bhikkhu is more to be respected and commended by me. Why is that? Because that will long conduce to his fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, easy support, and arousal of energy. Therefore, bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, How shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? So, a very high standard for what it means to be not an heir in material things. According to this, even when you are hungry and weak, and you there is food that is left over, you should. It is sometimes better to refuse it. And this is a statement that you. I must admit, when I read this, I find it interesting, but I also find it. I also wonder what exactly is meant here, because the Buddha also taught the middle way, right? And the middle way is not about going too far, whereby you suffer unnecessarily on the one hand, and yet not indulging yourself on the other hand. And if you're hungry and weak, it seems almost to me to be on the side of maybe creating too much suffering for yourself. That is what food is for, right? If you're weak, it is to give you that strength. So you neither overeat, as it says elsewhere in the suttas, you neither overeat nor do you undereat, but you find a middle way where the food can be used for practice. That is kind of the purpose. So this is one of the rare places where the Buddha goes to this this extent. And so what maybe this means, that this may be just like a rare occasion, that occasionally you go against your desires, right? And you go against something to test your resolve, to make sure that you have that ability to say no to things without being affected mentally. That is one possibility, and I think that is likely what this means. Or another possibility is that perhaps some of these terms, like weak here, for example, weak to me seems like too much. Perhaps this term has actually slipped in to the sutta and was not perhaps originally there. There are Chinese versions of the sutta as well, which I haven't read because I can't read Chinese. But it may, sometimes these things happen, that kind of commentarial terms slip into the suttas that were not there originally. So I'm a little bit kind of skeptical, perhaps, but it could also just be my own misunderstanding of what is going on. Anyway, this is what the Buddha says. So you have this very high standard for what it means not to take and not to say things. And what he says here, which is interesting, of course, that if you do that, if you do say no to these material things, then he is to be respected because it conduces to the fewness of wishes, right? To contentment, to effacement, to ease of support, and to the arousal of energy. And this is what is the important point here, that when you are able to say no to the material things of the world, when you're able to have that sort of discipline in your mind, then it's very easy to be content. It's very easy to be satisfied with what you have. You don't get carried away by these desires, by these aversions. The material things of the world don't kind of have you by the neck and pull you around. You're free of these things. And of course, if you are going to live somewhere in seclusion, that comes up next in the sutta, if you're going to be secluded somewhere and live far away, it's very handy to be content, easily contented, right? Particularly if you live far away, if you live in the jungle somewhere in Sri Lanka, say, or something like that, some of those forest monasteries in Sri Lanka can be quite tough, then it is very, very, very handy to have that strength of mind whereby you can say no to these things, to contentment. And contentment is one of those very important factors for the mind to be able to move towards stillness and peace and samadhi. You have to be content, right? If you're not content, contentment means that you don't really want anything else. You're happy where you are. You don't want to get rid of anything. You don't desire anything. You're just at peace. And of course, that sense of peace, that contentment is necessary for the mind to become even more peaceful and then enter the states of samadhi. A very important aspect in the gradual training, this idea of contentment, santuti, as it is called in the Pali language. Yes?
Bhante, did you think that this restriction, in this case on food, he's talking about actually causes a generalization right across the board with kamachanda?
Sure. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, kamachanda and acquisitiveness in general, or whatever it is. Yeah, indeed. Good point. This is like, I think that is why, that might also be one of the reasons why the example is quite extreme, because obviously anything less than that would certainly be included, right? So this is like,
Okay, so the flip side of that is that it inclines the mind towards peacefulness and stillness. Yeah. Would that be correct?
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting, I did the Dhamma Jiva course, the retreat over Christmas time. And that's one of the things that Venerable Dhamma Jiva is saying, that really it's, you know, if you want to take the leading edge on getting restraint or sense restraint, you best start with food. And that it generalises out to other things as well.
Yeah.
So that if you're good with food, you're probably good with, you know, all the other things that we get distracted by.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And if you're good with it, those desires that are very strong in a sense, if you can deal with those, and you can deal with the lesser ones, right? And food, when you go on retreat, food often becomes a big, big thing. It's kind of your outlet, so to speak. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think it is probably, well, you're asking why did the Buddha offer him the food? I think it's a hypothetical example. I don't think this has necessarily actually happened. I think the Buddha is saying, well, let's say hypothetically that I had this food and I were to offer them. I don't know any example of the Buddha actually doing that. So I think it's just as an example to show what's going on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't think it's trying to tempt them or anything like that.
What is more interesting to me is that, I mean, during Buddha's time, what was the practice? Of course, I believe there must be many monks living with the Buddha or around the Buddha, and they would have gone for alms, or they would share the, what's called Sangadana, whatever. Do they share? Or if somebody gives the Buddha, would they share with the Buddha, or would the Buddha share with other people?
Actually, that's a very interesting point, and one of the things the Buddha says, which I find very inspiring, he says that if you understood the power of generosity, in other words, as in practice of the spiritual path, you wouldn't eat a single meal without sharing it with someone. Huh? That's what he says somewhere. It's a very beautiful statement. You would never eat anything.
So I just find it a little bit
contradictory.
I'm trying to understand, you know, what is the daily life, what is the meaning of this in the context of that daily proceedings.
I think the context is that it is your duty to give, but it's also your duty to refuse a gift sometimes. So you do both. You give if somebody refuses to accept that, and you don't. So both things are right in a sense at the same time. But I must admit, if you look at the sutta, there is almost no mention of fasting anywhere in the sutta. The Buddha doesn't talk about fasting. He always talks about you go out for your daily meal, and you have your daily meal. There's no mention of actually skipping your daily meal as a practice. That is what the Buddha did before his awakening, right? He skipped his meals, he ate the rice or grain a day or whatever it was. So that's why this surprises me a little bit, because I feel it's a little bit, it seems to be, to me, it doesn't quite fit with the way I normally read the suttas. That is why I'm a little bit surprised. But then again, it
or
might.
Or typically how the Sangha does his daily business?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Usually, I mean, one meal a day seemed to have been kind of the standard in those days, yeah.
And sharing all the stuff together.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So, this is what happens when you... Anyway, when you do that, and sometimes it may be good to fast a little bit, you know. So maybe this is just a reference to the occasional time when you fast completely, and then you have fewness of wishes. You're learning how to deal with these things, right? You are content. Effacement. This term effacement, it almost means like you are erasing yourself. You're rubbing yourself out. It's like you are reducing your ego, your sense of self. This is what effacement sort of means. Because a lot of sense of self, I think, goes into sensual desires, right? But if you have less sensual desires, you're actually reducing your sense of self at the same time. These are very closely linked to each other. You're, of course, easy to support. And interesting as well here, he says that it leads to arousal of energy. And why is that? And this is because one of the things that you see in the suttas, where the Buddha says that the more desire you have and the more anger you have, in other words, the more defilements you have, the less energy you have on the path. Defilements are the enemy of the energy on the path. So if you are able to reduce the defilements, you actually get energy that way. Energy arises from that, from a lack of defilements. There is a particular sutta, actually, which talks specifically about this, called the Cetokhila Sutta, which is in Majjhima Nikaya number 16, the wilderness in the heart, and this explains precisely that. But if you have defilements, it drags the energy down. It's very hard to be energetic about these things. Kind of catch 22, right? You need a bit of energy to get rid of defilements, it's hard to kind of get anywhere. So it's sometimes you have to really bite your clench your teeth and sort of practice. So this is then what the Buddha is saying to these to the monks around him. Having said that, then the sutta goes on. That is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat, went into his dwelling. Soon after he had left, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus. "Friends, bhikkhus," "friend," they replied, "the Venerable Sariputta said this." "Friends, in what way do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded not train in seclusion?" And in what way do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion? And the monks reply, "Indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then, friends, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend," the bhikkhus replied, "the Venerable Sariputta said this." "Friends, in what way do disciples of the teacher who live secluded not train in seclusion?" Now, the first thing maybe before I go on is there's this change here from not being heirs in material things to the training in seclusion, which seems a bit kind of strained. It's moving from like one topic to another one without much explanation for what is happening here. But I think the point here is that there is actually a very strong connection in themes, because the first part shows you the kind of qualities of mind that are required to be able to live in seclusion, right? You have to have the contentment. You have to be easy to support. If you're going to live in the jungle by yourself, like some monastics do, it is very hard unless you have that contentment. So there's a natural movement here from that not being the heir in material things to living in seclusion. They go together, because it is precisely, seclusion is very strongly connected with ability in meditation, with mindfulness, with having samadhi, right? That's what seclusion is connected to. That is the exact opposite of being someone who's interested in the material world. So there is actually a strong connection here between the two.
Talking there about seclusion from the world, or is he talking about seclusion from the sense doors? Because when the word seclusion is used in the suttas, my understanding is that it can mean either of those two, going out under a tree in a forest, or actually shutting the sense doors and going deep into stillness and meditation.
Yeah.
Which one does he mean then?
It means both, because they go together, right? The only way that you're going to be able to live in seclusion in the forest for a long time is to actually be secluded from unwholesome states, right? Secluded from the sense doors, as you say. That's the only way it's going to work in the long run. But you're right, in the suttas you have this twofold kind of seclusion. One is called kaya viveka, which means seclusion of the body. That is like going into the forest, where just the body is secluded from the world. Then one is called the chitta viveka, seclusion of the mind. And that basically means abandoning the senses, like in samadhi. And of course, even more so, abandoning the five hindrances, is basically what it refers to. That's the chitta viveka, being secluded from those things. And they have to go together to some extent. Of course, so you start by purifying yourself as much as you can, and then you go into seclusion where the mind is already quite pure, and then you do the final purification in seclusion. So it's like a gradual moving away, right? It's happening there, both physically and mentally. Yeah, supporting each other. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the teacher who lives in seclusion, how do they not train in seclusion his disciples. So here, disciples of the teacher who live secluded do not train in seclusion. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon her. They are luxurious and careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion. You might phrase it, leaders in backsliding. It sounds pretty terrible. But it's actually quite a good translation of the Pali. Pali means something like going downhill or something like that. You know, basically, everything not being so good. So how do you not train in seclusion? So the first thing is that it says here, they do not train in seclusion, which basically probably just means that you are not secluded in body. You don't go off into the forest, into a hut, to Jhana Grove, to do a meditation retreat, whatever it is. You're physically not secluded. That's the first thing here. And then it says they do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. And this here probably can mean many, many things. But I think one of the things that it certainly means is precisely the citta viveka we're just talking about, Teresa. So this is the teacher tells you to abandon the defilements, to abandon the sense desires, right? And ultimately abandon the senses completely in samadhi. So you don't do that. So this here you have the kaya viveka and the citta viveka. And because you don't do that, because you don't get that seclusion of the mind, you tend to be more luxurious. It says here, careless. I don't think that's such a good translation. Maybe lax is better, luxurious and lax. In other words, you're kind of just enjoying yourself. So, you know, you're actually, you're not really moving in the right direction. For that reason, you tend to be luxurious. You're a leader in backsliding. You tend to go downhill. It's a bit like the Dhamma works. The Dhamma, as long as you have the right inspiration, right? As long as you're heading in the right direction, the Dhamma will carry you along because of that. So you have like the ideal in your head and you're slowly moving in the right direction. But sometimes there comes a point when you kind of lose the plot and you don't know what you're doing anymore. And suddenly instead of moving in the right direction because you lost the plot, then things tend to fall back because you don't know what you're doing anymore. It's very hard to sort of stand still. It's either you are inspired and you have enough confidence to drive yourself forward, or you forget what this monastic life is all about. You get caught up in administration, you get caught up in worldly duties, you get caught up in hierarchies. Maybe I can kind of make a career out of monastic life, right? Or something like that. And that is when these things kind of take over. So you always have to be very careful in them so that this doesn't happen. And then lastly, neglectful of seclusion. You stop trying even to be secluded because you are actually heading in the wrong direction. You're actually sliding backwards instead. So this is what is meant here by not training in seclusion. All these factors coming together. At the very least, even if you're not in seclusion, you should train for seclusion. So that you're moving towards seclusion at the very least. Okay. Then Venerable Sariputta goes on. In this, the elder bhikkhus are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who live secluded, they do not train in seclusion. They are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are to be blamed for this second reason. They are luxurious and lax, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion. They are to be blamed for this third reason. The elder bhikkhus are to be blamed for these three reasons. So these three reasons are slightly different. I think that's the point they're making out here. They're not exactly the same. One is that you're not trying to be physically secluded. One is that you're not abandoning the defilements. And the third one is that you are neglecting and you're luxurious instead. So three type of different things. Well, the first one here, the teacher lives secluded, they do not train in seclusion. The Pali word there is anusikati, which means literally to follow or to practice in accordance with. Not following the example is what it means there. So the first one is basically not taking up the example of the Buddha. You're not actually practicing accordance to the way he's practicing. And this is one of the things you see in many places in the suttas. You're supposed to take up the example of the Buddha and follow in his footsteps, right? And that, I think, is a very important point, because many of the suttas, the Buddha often teaches his biography, right, his autobiography. He tells about this is what I did and this is how I practiced. Why does the Buddha do that? And it's not to kind of instill the sense that, wow, the Buddha is so amazing, I can never do that. You know, he is just way beyond me. That's not the point, right? Because if he did that, it would just turn you off and you would feel inadequate. You wouldn't feel that you would be able to do it. That's not the point of saying this. The point of the Buddha explaining his own biography is to show what we should be doing. This is how we should be practicing, right? The Buddha is saying, I am a human being. I did this. You do the same. You are in the same. You follow my footsteps. If I can do it, you can do it. That's essentially what he's saying. If I can do it, you can do it. And that is a much more powerful teaching, isn't it? Rather than thinking of the Buddha as some kind of God or divine person, which is, in my opinion, completely misguided to think of the Buddha like that. It's the exact opposite. As it says here, you anusikati, you practice along in the same way as the Buddha does. That is what you're supposed to be doing here. So please, when you read the biography of the Buddha, be inspired. Think that here is someone marvelous who did something. I shall be doing, try to do the same thing. The Buddha is human, so am I. And it becomes very, that way, these life stories of the Buddha become very meaningful. It's not just a matter of worshipping someone or thinking of someone as wonderful and great. It's actually taking that inspiration away. And then, that's the first thing, just following the example of the Buddha. And the second thing, of course, the Buddha says here, Buddha says here, when the teacher tells them to abandon, they do not do that. So again, you follow the example of the Buddha and you follow the teaching of the Buddha. These are two things go hand in hand. It says elsewhere in the suttas that the way the Buddha practices and the way he teaches are always congruent, right? They always work together. It's not as if he says one thing and does something else, like many parents when they bring up the children, you know, don't do what I say kind of thing. But the Buddha is, do what I do and what I say, because they work together here. And the last one is just that they are basically moving entirely in the wrong direction. Not only are they not going in the forward direction, which the first two factors are about, they're actually going in reverse. You're going backwards. You are getting further and further away from the goal, which of course contradicts the whole purpose of living the monastic life. Okay, so that is the elder bhikkhus. They are to be blamed for these reasons, and not surprising, it is exactly the same for any old bhikkhu, and of course bhikkhunis too, and to some extent even for lay people, if you practice and you're going in reverse, that's not what you want to do, right? Yes, Huitong.
This abandonment here, is that related to the Vinaya?
No, this is Pahana, well, abandonment. Let me actually check that, because I'm just saying things now on a slightly vague notion, but to be absolutely sure, I will check what the word is, so that I don't lead you astray. It's easy enough to be led astray as it is. So, let's see what it says here. Pahana, yes, exactly. So, Pahana is the word. Pahana is the word that is used when you abandon the five hindrances. That's where it's most important use in the suttas. It means abandon the five hindrances.
But in this case, it seems like almost everyone will be most of the time be blamed because it's not reversed. I can't abandon.
Sorry, every monk will be what?
Most people will be blamed in this case. They do not abandon the five hindrances when the teacher tells them not to abandon.
It means that you're trying, right? You're moving in that direction.
But in this case, the word try is not there.
It isn't. I think you have to read it into the text. Because I think it's very clear that the suttas talk about the gradual training, right?
Yes.
You're gradually moving away from defilements, so you are abandoning them. Okay, let me check the Pali. It's an interesting point you're mentioning. Let's see what the Pali says, because you never know how these things translate. Yeah, basically the Pali says that those dhammas that the teacher says you should abandon, they do not abandon those dhammas. I think you can understand that as a gradual abandoning here. You're applying yourself to abandon them.
That means that you make a sincere attempt.
Yeah. That's what it means. Not only making a sincere attempt and also succeeding, but in a gradual sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So then we have the same for the middle monks. In this, the middle bhikkhus are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who lives secluded, they do not train in seclusion. They are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are to be blamed for this second reason. They are luxurious and lax, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion. They are to be blamed for this third reason. The middle bhikkhus are to be blamed for these three reasons. In this, the new bhikkhus are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciple of the teacher who lives secluded, they do not train in seclusion. They are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are to be blamed for this second reason. They are luxurious and lax, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion. They are to be blamed for this third reason. The new bhikkhus are to be blamed for these three reasons. So, everyone is to be blamed for these things. So if you are a monk, you have a duty to uphold this kind of lifestyle, basically. So, it's interesting here, also, maybe one small point that I didn't mention, is it says here, the disciples of a teacher who is secluded, right? So the Buddha is secluded. And the interesting thing, of course, is that the Buddha has made an end of all his defilements. He doesn't really have to live in seclusion. It's all finished. So why does he actually live in seclusion? And one of the reasons that Buddha gives in the suttas why he still practices in a more austere way than he probably had to is precisely to give the example for future generations. He says, I do it out of compassion for future generations. Because then when they see that I do this, they will follow along. Right? So you can imagine if the Buddha did not live in seclusion, then it would be even easier to justify yourself not to live in seclusion. But the fact that the Buddha does it gives him much more impetus in that direction. So the Buddha said there's two reasons why he lived in seclusion. One is out of compassion for future generations. And the second is because it's a pleasant abiding here and now. And that just means that the Buddha just enjoyed seclusion. It's the nature of someone who is an arahant fully awakened that you want to be secluded. You don't want to have anything to do with people. You just want to enjoy and bliss out in meditation practice. And people can only be a hindrance to that sort of thing here. It even says in one of the suttas later on here that when you come out of a very deep state of meditation, when people come around, whatever people, you give any kind of talk to kind of dismiss them as soon as possible. That's what it says, because you are, basically, you want to, you know the that this is not going to be compatible with your meditation practice. So there's a balance there between compassion and your own enjoyment of the deep meditation and the release of the mind that comes from that. Okay, so that is the negative side. And then comes the positive side, which is exactly the opposite. So we can probably go through this fairly quickly here. So, in what way, friends, do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion? Here, disciples of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are not luxurious and lax. They are keen to avoid backsliding. And they are leaders in seclusion. Interesting point there that you have to be a leader in seclusion, right? It's an interesting thing here. In other words, you cannot wait till your friends in the holy life do the things for you. You have to take charge of these things. You cannot wait till the rest of the monastic world is doing the right thing before you practice properly. You have to take responsibility now and take the lead in these kind of issues. You can't wait for others to do these things. That is, I think, a very important point, because often we look around and we look at what other people do. But actually, we shouldn't worry too much about what other people do. We should know for ourselves what is right and then practice accordingly. So you have to take that leadership position sometimes, which is interesting here. In this, the elder bhikkhus are to be commended for three reasons. As disciple of the teacher who lives secluded, they train in seclusion. They are to be commended for this first reason. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are to be commended for this second reason. They are not luxurious and lax. They are keen to avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. They are to be commended for this third reason. The elder bhikkhus are to be commended for these three reasons. In this, the middle bhikkhus and then also the new bhikkhus. I'll just abbreviate a little bit here. The new bhikkhus are to be commended for three reasons. A disciple of the teacher who lives secluded, they train in seclusion. They are to be commended for this first reason. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are commended for this second reason. They are not luxurious and lax. They avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. They are to be commended for this third reason. The new bhikkhus are to be commended for these three reasons. It is in this way that disciple of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion. So everything there is about seclusion, which is why I think that the citta viveka, the seclusion of the mind, is what is meant when we talk about abandoning things. Okay, so there we are. Now we come to some of the root causes and reasons for why these things happen in the first place, why people abandon seclusion and why they don't practice it properly. So, Venerable Sariputta says, friends, the evil herein is greed and hate. There is a middle way for the abandoning of greed and hate, giving vision, giving knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And what is that middle way? It is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, or right stillness. This is the middle way, giving vision, giving knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. So, the evil herein, I'm not sure if evil is such a good word, perhaps. Maybe the bad therein, or the kind of the bad herein might be better, is greed and hate. So the point here is, as far as I can see, that greed and hate are the root causes for why you have the backsliding, for why people do not want to practice seclusion, for why the monks are not following the example of the Buddha and following his teachings. It's greed. These defilements are the cause. They are what actually lie behind this. And so what the Buddha says, if you want to be someone who fulfills the idea of seclusion, fulfills the teaching of the Buddha, you have to abandon the greed and the hate, right? Lobha, dosa, two of the three root defilements. This is what you have to abandon. And so again, it brings it back to the basic teachings of Buddhism, right? Back to the very basic things we always talk about. Abandoning of defilements. And the way you abandon defilements, go back to even more basic teaching. Practice the Noble Eightfold Path. It always comes back to the same things again. You can read things, you can read about all these different things you're supposed to do and you have to be careful about. And it always comes back to the same point. Noble Eightfold Path is what you have to do. So that's where the action is, so to speak. An interesting point here as well is that he talks about greed, lobha, and dosa. And it's interesting that these two defilements are often singled out in the suttas. When we talk about meditation practice, we often talk about the five hindrances, right? But of those five hindrances, it's the first two ones that are often singled out as special, as something different from the rest. And very often, they will often be on their own without the three other defilements being there. And the reason for that is because these are the most crucial ones. These are the ones that matter the most. often people will ask questions, how do I abandon tiredness, sloth and torpor? Maybe tiredness is a better word. Tiredness and lethargy or something like that. How do I abandon restlessness? And the answer is very often, well, if you are very tired because you haven't had enough sleep, well, then you go and have a nap, right? That's the way to get rid of tiredness. But very often, the reason why these defilements are there is because the two first defilements are too strong. Yeah? They are the ones that drive the restlessness. They are the ones that drive the tiredness in the first place. When you're engaging in the sensual world, when you get angry, that's when you feel tired and the mind becomes restless. You know, engaging in the sensual world is always about the future, acquiring things, desire, restlessness, right? The mind is restless, craving things. Anger very often makes you tired afterwards. If you become upset about something, if you're tired afterwards. So it's by diminishing these defilements that actually all the five hindrances tend to come down. These are the two areas that we need to worry about. Very often, there isn't that much you can do about these other two defilements. Like tiredness and restlessness, you can't do very much about those things unless you tackle these two underlying deep-seated defilements in the mind. This is where really the work has to happen. It's only when you get very close to samadhi, when the meditation starts to become very deep, and these two first defilements start to disappear, that is when these other three hindrances start to kind of come into their own, and where you have to abandon them, perhaps. But for most of us, it is the sense desires and the anger that is basically the main issue, and that is what has to gradually come down. That's what the problem is. It's important to understand that, because it's very important to focus on those aspects that we can do something about, and not focus in the wrong area. Focus in the wrong area, you will just keep on banging your head against the proverbial brick wall and never get anywhere. So it's good to kind of focus in the right place. So, and of course, it is the middle way, right, for abandoning these things. Of course, the middle way, interesting, of course, is precisely this way where you don't torture yourself and you don't indulge, right? So we have to understand this sutta, even what we saw before about the body being weak, we have to understand it as at least not torturing yourself. You might be a bit hungry, but it's not actually causing a lot of physical problems. So you have to see that balance here, I think. And then this beautiful group of epithets here, which describe this middle way, right? Giving vision, right? Vision, this idea you can actually see things for the first time. You can actually see the world. This idea the Buddha is called the eye of the world, right? Because the Buddha sees, and then he teaches us afterwards. And then we too start to see after a while. Vision, knowledge, this is just another way of saying vision. You know and you see, same kind of thing. Leads to peace, right? Of course, when it says peace, it means really, really deep peace, right? Complete peace. Direct knowledge, in other words, real understanding of the most profound phenomena, to enlightenment, to awakening, sambodhi. Awakening, I think, is a better translation. I prefer that personally. And to nibbana. Nibbana quite literally means extinguishment. You're extinguishing something. And I think it's very useful sometimes to translate nibbana instead of just leaving this word in there. When you leave it in there, you kind of have no feeling for it. It sounds like this thing you're supposed to move towards. But actually, it means extinguishment. What you're moving towards is extinguishing something. What you are extinguishing here is greed and hatred, right? When you extinguish that, the mind becomes very, very beautiful and very peaceful, very calm, very placid. You know that what it's like when you become peaceful even a little bit, and these things are extinguished a little bit, you already feel great, right? The more things disappear, the kind of the better you feel inside of yourself. It feels like a liberation, a freedom from this terrible oppression inside of you. And I'm sure you all can relate to that to some extent, how these things are an oppression, an affliction, a pain, something to be moved away from. So extinguishment in the Pali language, nibbana, has a very, very positive connotation. Don't think of extinguishment as something which kind of feels negative. It's actually something very beautiful. You are extinguishing these flames, these fires inside of you. So, and of course then it is the Noble Eightfold Path that is that middle way here. And yeah, I don't think we need to go into details about that now. And then, so those are the two root defilements, and then there are a large number of other defilements that are mentioned next. And it is enough probably to work with greed and hatred, but sometimes it can be useful to also consider these other types of defilements, because sometimes some of these other defilements, you can actually do something about them. First one here is anger and resentment, very similar to ill will, right, to the dosa we saw before. I'm not sure if there's much to be said about that. Contempt and insolence. I think the word contempt here is means like you are almost like you are looking down upon others, and or you are saying bad things about them. You're smearing their name and that sort of thing here. So it's basically a kind of what is the right word for that? Sorry? Slander, yeah. Anyway, you've got a different translation here. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Anger and revenge. Okay, which book is that? That's a photocopy from the library. Okay, I wonder which one. It might be that Bhikkhu Bodhi has updated his suttas and changed some of the terminology. So that one of our versions is probably older than the other one. I'm not sure which one is. What does it have in the next one, Lynn? Yeah? Okay, and the average is the same, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'm not sure which one is the later one. But anyway, it doesn't matter here. So, yeah, I think contempt here is a bit like looking down upon somebody here, basically, and kind of slandering them and you know, whatever, yeah. And insolence. I think the problem here is quite difficult to have an exact translation of some of these terms. I'm not sure exactly myself what they mean, but they obviously refer to states of mind that are not healthy. It's the opposite of metta, the opposite of compassion, right? Things which are not a good relationship with other people. Envy and avarice. Envy is quite a good translation. This is quite a common word in the suttas. Issa can mean either envy or jealousy, which are very closely related. Avarice is not such a good translation. This actually means stinginess is more correct translation here. And stinginess is, of course, the exact opposite of being generous, right? You're kind of close. You don't want to share with others. One of the worst types of stinginess mentions that the stinginess is called Dhamma stinginess. Dhamma macharya is the Pali word. Dhamma macharya, it means that you're stingy, you don't want to share the Dhamma, or you don't want to teach others or whatever. And that is one of the types of stinginess that are actually specifically mentioned. And you know that, the feeling of generosity is very beautiful, right? Like you have an open heart, you want to share with others, you want to help others out. It's a very nice feeling here. And this is one of the things that closes you down if you have this stinginess instead. Deceit and fraud, this means like not so much actually deceiving someone kind of, you know, in commerce or something like that. It just means that you're carrot, you're not showing yourself as you are. You're kind of trying to get your ways by doing things in a kind of sneaky fashion or whatever. You're not straight about things. You're not direct about things. And this is a big obstacle on the path again. Obstinacy and rivalry. I think obstinacy is probably roughly right. You have an obstinate mind, not willing to kind of listen to reason or whatever. Conceit and arrogance could also be pride and arrogance. And the last one, vanity and negligence. Negligence probably should be heedlessness. And vanity could here possibly be translated as intoxication. You're intoxicated with things, intoxicated with desires, intoxicated with the sensual world, intoxicated with whatever it is. And the last one, heedlessness. In other words, you're not really thinking properly. You're not taking care of what you're doing. So you can see there's a whole set of things there. And I'm sure you can recognize many of these things straight away. And you know when the mind is defiled, right? When you feel proud, when you feel arrogant or whatever. And it's good to have that in mind and kind of, you know, there's always a way. learning how can I look at this situation differently? So I don't feel proud. I don't feel arrogant about this. How can I think about these things differently? Is there really any point in feeling arrogant? Is that going to help anybody? Do I have any reason for feeling arrogant? It's like feeling superior, right? You're arrogant. These lesser beings, you know, I'm more. I know more or whatever. And you know that is a completely wrong way of thinking. The Buddha didn't think like that. And the Buddha knew more about the spiritual life than all of us. So there isn't really much basis for having arrogance or pride. So you learn to shift your perception, to look at things in a new way, so you don't have these defilements. And of course, this reduces your sense of self, right? Very often. And when your sense of self is reduced, you also have less desires and anger very often. All these things go together. You're generally reducing defilements means you're generally kind of heading in the right direction. Less sense of self, less anger, less desire. Everything going together in a nice way. So the main point here, rather than maybe picking these things apart too much, is to just to understand your defilements, understand when the mind is not straight, when you're looking at the world in a crooked way, so to speak. Okay, and then again, the same thing. There is, in each of these cases, there is the middle way for the abandoning of these things, the middle way for the abandoning of intoxication and heedlessness, which gives rise to vision, knowledge, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, and to extinguishment. And what is that middle way? It is just the Noble Eightfold Path. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said, and the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. The Dhamma Dayara Sutta. So, any last questions and comments? Yes, John. Yeah.
Oh, it's just very simple, but it comes up quite often in the suttas, is disposing of unused alms food. The Buddha says don't put it on greenery or don't put it in where living beings are in the water, but that sounds quite opposite to what you could use the food for.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I was actually going to talk about that. It slipped out of my out while I was reading it. So thanks for mentioning that. When I read that, I kind of stumble a bit. I wonder what exactly is going on there. And I think what is going on is that you don't want to destroy anything here. If you throw a lot of food on grass, for example, the grass might rot underneath the food or something like that. If you put food in a kind of small pond where there are a few little beings, maybe you will cause damage to those beings that are putting the food in there. I think that it's something like that which lies behind this, that you're actually causing damage to something. I think that is the reason. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't be generous. Of course, one of the great things about having a little bit of alms food, and in the monastery you do this all the time, right? The kangaroos come out and you pour it out for them. They love human food, right? Can imagine if you eat grass all the time and you get some chocolate cake or something like that, you know? You can see the eyes brightening up, right? Chocolate cake, wow, this is amazing. you can see that. And of course, it's wonderful to share. We share with the little bobtail lizards, you know. Sometimes you just share with the insects. It's a wonderful thing to do. So I think it's important not to read this in the wrong way. It means to be careful, not to destroy anything, but at the same time, use the opportunity to actually share what you have. There is one place in the suttas where the Buddha says that even if you just have a few rice grains left in the dishwashing water, do you remember that? He says that even if there's a few rice left after washing the dishes, even if you have the intention, may these little insects enjoy this one, that's already good karma. So it is so easy to make good karma if you just use the opportunities in daily life, right? There are so many opportunities. Any act you do can either be done with a kind of wrong attitude or with the right attitude. Almost any act you do can be done the right way or the wrong way. So if you have that awareness, if you have enough mindfulness to always try to have the right intention when you do something, I do this for you, right? Please, this is my generosity. Even when I come up here and give the sutta reading here, I can think, be very proud and very kind of, I'm giving the sutta reading here and I'm going to, you know, I know more than these people, so I'm going to kind of teach them a few Pali words or whatever. And if you do that, you destroy the opportunity for actually doing something beautiful and say, I would like to share this little knowledge that I have. And if people don't like it, It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. If people already know it, it's also irrelevant. I'm just doing my best to be, you know, to do something nice and to be generous. And if I come from my teaching in as a sense of generosity, then you don't feel very nervous either. You know, you can speak in front of a group of people. It doesn't really matter because you're just trying to help out. But if you feel that it's about you kind of presenting yourself or whatever, then it becomes much more difficult to be a public speaker. So all of these things are about attitude. And once you understand that, you can make the whole, everything in life can become kind of part of the path, right? What is your intention? How do you use every opportunity to make it something beautiful? And when you speak to someone in a daily life, every interaction with other people and beings. So yeah, so thanks for bringing that up, John. I had intended to talk about that, so that is that's good. Yeah. Yes. I think so, because it is, you have to find a way to using all that food in a good way, right? At the monastery, we get so much food. And the only way that we can do it in the monastery is to put the food on the compost. We can't give it all to the animals. The animals will go obese, and they will lose all their teeth, and they will die from all the human food. So we have to kind of find that balance. So in the monastery, we compost the food. Then we use it afterwards on the, you know, on plants or whatever. I think that's a great way of doing it in the monastery. We usually ask people to take the food back if they can, because if they take it back, they can use it at home or whatever. But a lot, there's so much food sometimes that you can't actually take everything back. Yeah. So that is what we do. Yeah. The worms. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. So do it with a kind intention, and everything kind of comes together. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else would like to say anything? Yeah. Oh, we've got some. Coming from via the internet, so see what they have to say. Thank you, Christina. Okay, so this is Fred from the UK. Hello, Fred. Nice to hear from you. So, is it okay for laymen to make large earnings teaching Buddhism, or should we trust these teachers? I recently went to a retreat in the Theravada monastery in the UK, and a nun spoke of a famous meditation spirit teacher as an enlightened being. When I raised the questions of the millions this person makes with his talks and TV, she just answered that the poor guy is not the monk and thus has to survive somehow. Okay, what is your opinion here? I think there is obviously some truth to that, you know, if you are a lay person and you are a teacher, you have to survive. I mean, obviously that is true, but it depends on how you survive. And if you are a lay teacher and you are supposed to be highly attained, then normally you would also live a very, very simple life, right? So how is this person living, you have to ask yourself. If it is true that he is making millions, then what does he use those millions on? Does he give them away? Does he buy himself a Rolls Royce? You know, what is he doing? And this is the question we need to ask. But if he lives a very, very simple life, and he's a very impressive person in many ways, and to find that out, you have to observe the person over a long period of time. The Buddha said, if you want to know somebody's wisdom, if you want to know somebody's integrity, you have to be observant, you have to be mindful, and you have to observe for a long period of time to know that these personality factors actually are for real. It's not just a show or anything like that. So observe. Use your own intelligence, Fred. Don't just believe what other people say. Use your own sense of what is right and what works. It is so important to take charge of your own spiritual life and not just believe what kind of the group says. There's too much group thing sometimes. Everybody says this person is enlightened, and for that reason everybody else thinks he is enlightened. Think for yourself. I recommend that. The vast majority of times when everybody says someone is enlightened, usually if everybody says so, it means they're not. That's very often the case, unfortunately. So use your intelligence, and then you will see whether this is true or not. Very often, if somebody really is very far advanced on the spiritual path, it is very often that they will actually become monastics, because The whole path is a path of renouncing, right? This is the whole point. If your meditation becomes deep, that itself is renunciation. The only way you can get there is to renounce. So you are on the path of renunciation. You are renouncing it. So it is kind of natural to move into monastic life where you can be supported by, you know, by the generosity of people for living that renunciant lifestyle. So what, you know, one of the questions you could ask is, well, how come this monk, if they really are awakened or whatever, how come they're not a monastic? According to the suttas, if you are an arahant, if you're fully awakened, you have to be a monastic because you have no longer any attachments at all to the household life, and you're incapable of living an ordinary household life by storing up stuff in the house as before. So I would just recommend you to judge for yourself. Don't be kind of taken for a ride because you haven't actually watched carefully for yourself. That's what I would recommend. And then judge either one way or the other. And then when you see for yourself what is right, then you can sort of move in the right direction. Okay, so I hope that helps. Anybody else wants to say anything here? Yeah, we're talking here. Okay, so maybe over here. Since the microphone is so close down there. Okay. Okay. It's not about loudness, it's like getting it onto the video. Yeah.
I was just wondering why when Sariputta is making his points about what's blameworthy and what's commendable, why he directs them specifically to the elder and then the middle and then the new vicars?
Yeah. That's a good point. It may be that he wants to show how all-encompassing it is. That maybe it's easy to think, oh yeah, this is for an elder monk, because the elder monks are supposed to be the leaders in the Buddhist community, right? So it's really for them. But he's pointing out, actually, it's for everybody. This concerns everybody. It may just be that, but to say it's a very universal thing, and everybody has this obligation. I suspect that's it. Yes?
Was there any other teachers apart from Sariputta?
If there are any other teachers?
Was there any other teachers apart from some?
There were lots of teachers in those days. And you will actually find one of the interesting things in the suttas is that to be a monk who is fulfilled in all respects, or a nun who is fulfilled in all respects, one of those respects is actually to be able to teach properly. So you're supposed to be a teacher. You're supposed to kind of spread the Dhamma with other people. You find that in the sutta called the simile of the cowherd, if you want to have a look at it. I think it's number 32 or 33. And it specifically said that you are supposed to teach other people. And it's not only when you are fully awakened. You don't have to be an arahant or fully awakened to do that. This being able to teach actually comes fairly early on the path. Because one of the great things about teaching is that you learn so much by teaching. You know, when you come up here, you have to sort of know what you're talking about. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't work, right? So it makes you think about the teachings in an entirely new way. When somebody asks a question and you answer a bit too fast, you think afterward, gee, did I say something completely silly? Am I making any sense here? And it makes you think in a new way. And it makes you actually expand. Your understanding of Buddhism just goes skyrocket so fast when you teach. The teaching is a great thing, and it's something all monastics should do. Lay people can do it too. It's not a monastic kind of... There's nothing in the sutta that said monastics must be the teachers. Of course, there is a tendency for that, because as a monastic, you are like the professional. It's like you go to medical school, you have other doctors who teach you, so you are the professional, so there's a tendency. But there are some lay people who have enormous understanding of Buddhist teachings, and there's no reason why they shouldn't teach. There's no reason why they shouldn't teach monastics. We can reverse roles. There's no reason why not. Or why women shouldn't teach men, or men should teach women, or nuns should teach monks, and monks, nuns. And you know, it's just about, basically, it's about who knows, who has the ability to teach. That is what matters, nothing else. Did you want some specific names of the teachers, or? Okay. Well, the two main teachers, perhaps, in the suttas after the Buddha, there's Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana. They were known as the Buddha's right hand and left hand disciples specifically. So they're obviously very important teachers. Another very important teacher is Venerable Ananda. He was the one who always followed the Buddha. He was the Buddha's attendant. He learned almost every discourse. He has incredible memory, and he learned every discourse the Buddha taught. And he was a very important teacher in those days. There is not a lot of discourses by nuns, and I think the reason for that is because the nuns community was separate from the monks community. So when the Ananda and those people who learned the suttas wouldn't have heard what the nuns were teaching. But there are a few teachings by nuns. And one of those is found, I think, Majjhima Nikaya 44, and that's the nun Kema. Is that Kema Venerable? I think it's the nun Kema. She was one of the Arahant nuns at that time. Dhammadinna, yeah. So she is featured there as a teacher. There are many others. There's Mahakachana, who was famous for being able to, the Buddha would give a statement in short, he would expand it, he was famous for that. There are a number of other monks as well, yeah. And occasionally lay people. One of the nice stories that I like to read out is the story of Citta the householder. Citta the householder was a very attained lay person, very profound meditation. And he says, in one of his suttas, he says that when I go to visit the monks, to offer food to the monks, either they teach me the Dhamma, and if they don't teach me the Dhamma, I teach them the Dhamma. That's quite nice, isn't it? I like that sentiment there. So. It is not recorded. I think it is probably unlikely because the Sanghas tended to be separate. So I think probably not, although there is no absolute certainty around these things. But it's certainly not recorded that they were there. Yeah. Yeah. Not really, no. I think giving knowledge means understanding deeply. Yeah. It means a full understanding. Like being a stream enterer, you have a full understanding of the Dhamma. That's what it talks about. Sometimes you just have different words which are almost synonymous. So one is abhinya and one is jnana. And one, the difference between the two words is that one has the prefix abhi. Otherwise, exactly the same word, basically. Yeah. And if you want to say a difference between the two, you can maybe say that jnana, which is just knowledge, is like the understanding of the stream mentor. You understand the teachings in the inferential sense. A stream mentor, for example, would understand dependent arising. Dependent arising is the process of rebirth that happens as a consequence of craving. It doesn't mean that the stream mentor has understood or seen their past lives or whatever. That doesn't necessarily mean that. But it means that you understand the law of causality, that craving must always give rise to a new life in the future. It's understanding a process. It's understanding a mechanism of causality that happens. So this is insight into the Dhamma, understanding a mechanism. Whereas abhinya is more like a direct knowledge. You actually see your past lives, right? And you see something directly with your eyes. It's not inferential. You don't make an inference. In one of them, you understand the structure, how one thing must lead to something else, and therefore you understand that there must be rebirth. In another one, you actually see rebirth with your eyes. So, yeah. Direct knowledge is an immediate understanding. You recollect your past life, and you see, I see past lives, right? Just knowledge is seeing the... seeing the structure of things, the principle of things. Yeah. Everybody happy? Yeah. Who talking? Yeah.
Closely related to this sutta, but I understand that Ajahn Brahms keep. One favorite example or one favorite thing that he keeps like to say is the anger eating demon and how to deal with it.
Yeah.
He keeps saying that comes from the Udana, And I try to look at it in Udana and can't find it. So do I have a problem? Is it in Udana or?
I think it might be in the Sanyutta Nikaya. I'm not sure. If you wish, I can find it for you. I'll be very happy to find it for you.
I believe I've come through Udana itself.
Go to the library, look up his book, what's it called? Open Door of Your Heart. And should be a reference in there at the back of that book, which gives the exact reference to the story. Is it? Which is that? Devas. Okay. Ramananda said it from the Sanghita Nikaya. So I think that might be right. I think that's what I remember as well. I think that's right. Or is it the Kosala Sanghita? No? Okay. Yeah. Oh, it's a Sakka Sanghita. Okay. I think that's where it is. Okay. So I think it's the Sakka Sanghita in the Sanghita Nikaya. But look it up in the opening door of your heart. Yeah. Okay. Everybody happy? Yeah. Yes. Okay.